Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for August 15th, 2019, the Public Charge Edition. I am David Plotz of Atlas Obscura. I am not in Washington, not in New York. I'm actually in my brother's dining room in Boston, Massachusetts, because it's that kind of year. And joining me from somewhere, I saw her yesterday, so she's probably in New Haven. I saw her in New Haven, is Emily Bazelon of Yale and the New York Times.
Yes, indeed. I am still in New Haven where you left me.
I hope you're not where I left you, which was like in your house. You're probably in a studio.
I'm in the Yale studio, my happy place for recording.
And John is still trying to negotiate peace in Europe. And so he is not with us, but that's okay. Because we have Josie Duffy Rice, who is now the president of the appeal. We have a president on our show.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
And Josie's joining us from Sea Island, Georgia.
Yes.
That means that she, too, has a kind of vacation mode. It's going to be a vacation mode kind of gabfest, even though the news is totally dire. So maybe it won't be that vacation-y. On today's gabfest, we're going to talk about the obscene new effort by the Trump administration to restrict legal immigrants by punishing them for taking, accepting, using public benefits. Then we're going to talk about Jeffrey Epstein's suicide and the cloud that it put over, well, just about everyone in the whole country, apparently, or every man in the whole country. Then, oh, and actually one woman too. Then Trump's on again, off again, China tariffs and the recession risk that we face. What is going on with the economy? How disastrous is this likely to be for the U.S. and for the world? And what effect will it have on the election? Plus, of course, we're going to have cocktail chatter and a reminder that we are coming to the Twin Cities for our first live show in Minnesota. We're going to be at the Fitzgerald Theater in St. Paul, Wednesday, September 18th. There's still tickets available. Go to slate.com/live for tickets to that show on Wednesday, September 18th at the Fitzgerald Theater in St. Paul, Minnesota. Here's an actual line from an actual real-life Trump official this week. Give me your tired and your poor who can stand on their own two feet and who will not become a public charge. That, of course, was Ken Cuccinelli, who is the acting director of the USCIS, the folks who deal with citizenship and immigration. For the Trump administration, the administration has escalated its really vicious war on immigration that now going after legal immigrants with a radical new interpretation of an old law. So, Emily, what is going on? What's the law that's being reinterpreted? What is the Trump administration trying to do? And if you think it's as outrageous as I do, which I bet you do, why is it outrageous?
The original version of this law actually dates from the 1880s, around the same time as the Chinese Exclusion Act, which could give you some idea about the origins here. And, you know, since the 1880s, we've had some provision in immigration law for preventing people from becoming naturalized or citizens if they could be a public charge to the country. And originally, there was this sort of old-fashioned language about being an idiot or a pauper or a convict. And again, you can see the kind of what's like the underlying concern here. It's about burdening the country with undesirable people. The statute was updated in the 1960s and then also reinterpreted more recently in a way that meant that that we were having a very limited application of it. And so if you were in the country legally, if you had a green card, you were applying to be naturalized, you were trying to get a green card, the government would only block you if more than half your income was coming from traditional welfare. And I'm talking about temporary assistance for needy families, the TANF program, or SSI, which is the benefits for people who are disabled. As long as you didn't fall into that category of more than half your income coming from one of those programs, then we didn't hold it against you when we were thinking about letting you stay, what your income was, whether you had other kinds of public benefits like Medicaid or WIC, the program for women when their children are first born. In other words, we were able to recognize that immigrants may need some kind of temporary leg up when they get here, but that doesn't mean they're going to be a public charge, like a burden in the long run. What the Trump administration has done is issue this very long, it has more than 800 pages, rule, creating all these new categories for keeping people from staying or keeping people out in the first place based on this kind of conjecture about whether they're going to cost some money to the government in the short or the long term. It seems like there are lots of reasons people could be deemed to be public charges, and that a lot of it is like speculation as opposed to how they're really using benefits. And the problem with this, of course, is that lots of immigrants need some temporary help, but as a group, they contribute much more in the end than they take. And this is also just obviously so at odds with our whole tradition of immigrants drivers and the notion that people get here and they have all kinds of qualities that helps them succeed in the longer term. And it's really just about shaming people for poverty, however temporary. And so I guess I'll end on that as like my answer to why this is so troubling.
Josie, in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, the percentage of people who were rejected for this public charge standard was in the high teens. I think it was 17%. And then changes made during both the Clinton administration and then I think more recently have reduced that number to around 1%. So it's very, very few people have been denied green cards or citizenship because of the possibility or the likelihood they would be public charges. So do we know, sort of from a philosophical perspective, like, is there a correct number? Is 1% a correct number? Is 17% a correct number? Is 50% a correct number? Is there any case that you could make if you're a Trump official that, oh, we've become way too lenient about this?
Well, I mean, I think if you're a Trump official, if you're working in this administration, right, to quote Adam Serwer, that cruelty is kind of the point. And so this actually isn't about the percentage or the number. It's about the fact that they are instituting more strict regulations around something where they have the right to sort of predict how many resources an immigrant they think is going to use, even if they haven't done it yet. So what we're seeing is both like the predictive factor, which is unscientific, and the stats they are using are inaccurate and just is a complete open door to more racism and classism from this administration. But it's also just such a perversion of power and a manipulation of what is supposed to be a country that has a good faith understanding of what it takes to move to a new country and make it, right? And so I don't think that the number is the point. I think the intention is so, so important here. And when we're talking about Stephen Miller creating immigration policy, there's so rarely anything good that can possibly come out of that.
I mean, it's an outrageous standard. It's absolutely outrageous. So a majority of Americans use some form of these public benefits in their life. It is part of the life cycle, especially if you're an immigrant, if you've come with very few resources. It makes perfect sense that you would want to take advantage of this so that you could be able to provide housing and food and medical care for yourself and your loved ones. And it's absolutely ridiculous. It's disgusting and dehumanizing to create this standard, which is the only people who are entitled, who deserve to be here, are people who don't, you know, need these things, which are basic human needs. Everyone needs food. Everyone needs housing. Everyone needs healthcare. And it's simply, you know, vile. And Josie, to pile on to your point, the fact that it isn't even an absolute standard, it's something which is based on a likelihood. It's something that an official can determine on their own based on how they feel that day. If they, you know, if they themselves have low blood sugar or something, it's very sinister and malevolent. And it's part of this entire movement of dehumanization that we've seen out of this administration, out of a lot of the Republican Party, in fact, frankly, when you think about how they treat ex-felons, how they treat people who've crossed the border without papers. It's really disgusting.
Can we also just have a moment of reserving, like, particular distress for Ken Cuccinelli, who is the current head of UC, what's it called? USCIS. This is like our Customs and Immigration Service at the moment, the part of the INS that the old INS that deals with these issues. you know, he's like wrecking the Statute of Liberty inscription by talking about how we only want your tired and your poor if they can stand on their own 2 feet. And then when Aaron Burnett of CNN challenged him about the nation's tradition of taking people, like certainly like my great grandparents who came here with nothing, he says like, well, those were Europeans, as if that is different from, taking poor people from other parts of the world who, oh, just happen not to be white. I mean, there is just this, again, this like willingness to talk about white ethno-nationalism as an acceptable basis for discriminating against people from other parts of the world. And, you know, what's really going on here is this underlying struggle for minority rule. And what I mean by minority is white conservatives afraid that people coming to this country who are not white are not going to continue voting for conservative candidates and for the Republican Party. And it's really about trying to prevent the country's demographics from changing.
Josie, one of the things that's striking about this regulation as opposed to the most of the rest of the Trump war on immigration and immigrants is that it is targeted against people who are here legally. This has nothing to do with their, you know, with the invasions they love to talk about over at Stephen Miller's office. It's a way in particular of keeping families apart, because the people who are most likely to be affected by this are people who are coming in some form of family unification, as well as people coming in the green card lottery. What do you make of this shift from immigration as, oh, we have to prevent an illegal abuse of our system, to now being one which is we have to prevent anybody coming here who's not a white European, that is, who's not Norwegian?
Well, right. I mean, it's so much of this is about race, right? So much of this is about ethnicity, but a lot of it is also about class and the fact that what they're basically saying is that we only want you here if you are rich, if you, you know, have already had the benefits that you might be looking for, the opportunity that you might be looking for in coming to a place like America. And I think, you know, ultimately this really highlights the Trump administration and really all conservatives, or the Republican Party right now, their perspective on what is taking and what is giving, right? What is investment and what is welfare? This idea that all these people are doing, all these legal immigrants or immigrants at all are doing, is taking from us, is so out of line with what the data says. It's so out of line with our understanding of what it means to invest in people as long as they're the right people. And it ignores sort of the public benefits that conservatives and the right and people with means are receiving from this country in every single day, all the time, in every way. This idea that like these people are just living off of our hard work, right? Or citizens' hard work is just so disproven by the data and such an indication of the racism and, again, the just pure hatred for poor people that kind of drives this kind of policy.
To follow up on that a little bit, Josie, one of the things that was, again, so freaking demoralizing with these people is the raids that were done in Mississippi in this past week, where about 700 people who were here in an undocumented way working illegally were swept up and will be deported and their families broken up, and were the employers who were benefiting from that, the employers who were knowingly hiring people in this way, punished or at all chastised? No, not at all. The Trump administration has stopped any kind of attempt to restrain the employers who are the ones who are in a way most responsible for it. And instead, it's just like, oh, let's just hurt the poor people who are actually doing the work.
Yeah. And you see this kind of all the time in the criminal justice system as well, right? The way that we criminalize poverty. It's worse to steal a beer from the 7-Eleven than it is to cheat your employees out of their wages. Really only one of those traditionally has been seen as theft, and the other one has been seen as, you know, a licensing issue or a business regulation issue instead of an actual question of following the law. You know, these employers in the years past before these raids were threatening their employees allegedly and not allowing them to kind of get to not following any sort of labor regulations under the threat of, if you complain, we'll have you deported. And that sort of the ability to take advantage of a system that does not protect undocumented immigrants while also having the politics of saying that you don't actually want them there is just such a such a remarkable manipulation and hypocrisy that you see from not just the employers in Mississippi, right? But that happens nationwide. I mean, the raid itself is unusual, but the way that these employees were treated is not.
Can I ask a question that's a little bit off topic, but I've been thinking about it a lot lately in the wake of this just like sloshing of, you know, racist rhetoric and actions like this one from the Trump administration. I've just been worrying more and more that as reprehensible as I find these policy choices, and you do too, that they are not going to move the part of the electorate that would need to move in order to elect a different president, at least if you buy into the notion that it's the Rust Belt states and voters in those states that are going to determine this election. It's self-contested. But let's just go with this thesis that, you know, there have to be some people who voted for Trump or stayed home who need to show up. And this whole question of just like making the country care about the more obvious racist rhetoric and actions that we're seeing. Like, is there a way to talk about the underlying concerns here that makes white Americans who are pretty numb to this stuff actually like care about it more? Or, you know, in the calling out and denouncing of it, are we just like alienating people who feel then like they're getting implicated because like they've already bought into enough of this that if they really stop and think about what's happening, then they're just going to have to feel bad about their own choices. I just keep worrying that, you know, Trump is onto something, that he's kind of reinforcing some white Americans' kind of willingness to just be numb or kind of countenance the whole thing, like leave it alone. And that it, I don't know, just it's not that, I mean, I think it's really important to cover this issue, and maybe this particular question isn't the one that lends itself to my concerns, but I'm just worried about this idea of like amplifying racial division, which Trump seems to be trying to capitalize on right now.
You know, I wonder, so I've two thoughts about that. The first is that I don't know at this point if we morally have an option to do anything but respond strongly to Trump's racist, not only his rhetoric, but his policies. But I think to your point, it's interesting to imagine what would have to happen, right? What kind of atrocities would have to happen for people to abandon their support of him? And it's, you know, it's kind of like this classic psychology thing of, you know, I'm a good person, so I can't be okay with bad things. And if I'm okay with this, it must not be a bad thing. But there's this other kind of political philosophy question that I keep thinking of, which is this party of quote unquote small government is sitting by as the administration flouts every rule and breaks every, you know, it has really no consideration for the rule of law or even tradition in this country, and why that isn't more alarming. And the reality is because when people talk about big government, they're really talking about that they don't want to pay taxes. They're not actually as concerned with big government acting in a big government way if it doesn't directly affect them.
Yeah, I mean, Emily, I think when you and I were in New Haven, we talked about this, that the real strong political argument for President Trump's opponents is going to be around competence and the incompetence and the chaos and the kind of embarrassment, but that the on a lot of the actual policy provisions, especially I think where it comes to immigration, it's not a winning political issue. That doesn't mean that, you know, we aren't morally obligated to try to stop it and morally obligated to stand against it, but it may well not cause any gain when it comes to the election. And then rather, if you think the highest goal is to win the election, then you look for things which really do make the president look stupid, look embarrassed, look bad at his job. And I don't think that this particular form of regulation And this particular line of attack is going to be that. But, you know, you fight different battles at different times and for different reasons.
Yeah, that seems right to me. And also, thinking about this policy choice is totally legitimate for more reasons, and also because it's actually going to affect a lot of people, right? I mean, it's not one of those moments where, like, there's a lot of lefty outrage over, like, a photo op or, you know, one kind of stray bit of rhetoric. Like, this is actually going to really hurt a lot of people. Some of them are going to be barred from citizenship or entry. Some of them are going to drop their benefits out of fear. So, yes,
yeah, they worked on this. Right, they spent time on this. They wrote 837 pages. That's not
right.
That's yes, a real
and
effort.
That's another really good point. Yeah, because, you know, part of what happened when Stephen Miller got started on the travel ban was that it was done in such a ham-handed way that it was easy for the courts to say, no, you didn't follow the rules. But when you see an 837-page rule like this, then you think, oh, these people went through notice and comment. They probably now have wised up to enough of the procedures that are necessary for federal rules to survive judicial review that, like, this one very may well hold up. And that is about the power of the executive and the importance of elections.
I think your point about the chaos, too, is totally right, that there's a sense of this eventually becoming so exhausting for the day-to-day, even his supporters. The fact that Trump is so unpredictable and so vitriolic and, frankly, just so vengeful and unwilling to kind of follow any sort of traditional presidential path in terms of behavior, and also likes to be the center of attention, right? It really highlights just how much time we spend thinking about the president in a way that feels somewhat unprecedented to me, at least in the past few generations, of just the mental space he takes up, I think, regardless of what party you're in, and how ideally, right, you wouldn't have to think about the president every single day. You could sort of live your life and hope they had the best interest at heart. And the fact that they were not causing a lot of commotion would be a good thing. But, one of the many things that scares me about 2020 is just the idea of 4 more years of this, right? This kind of the mental real estate he takes up.
Slate Plus members, you get bonus segments, of course, on the Gabfest and other Slate podcast today. On Slate Plus, the case for and against Charentine. I'm not really sure what the case for and against Charentine the cases are, so I'm excited to have the Slate Plus segment, and Emily and Josie are going to enlighten me about Charentine and what it is. It's going to be amazing. There's going to be a lot of talk of Instagram, I think, and Facebook and other platforms. Go to slate.com/gabfestplus to become a member today.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Jeffrey Epstein committed suicide, or did he? In the Metropolitan Correctional Center, a federal jail in Manhattan. He had attempted suicide 3 weeks earlier. He'd been taken off suicide watch. His roommate had been removed from his cell. The guards were asleep. They lied about checking on him. And lo and behold, the 66-year-old sexual predator, pedophile, all-around vile human being seems to have killed himself. Or maybe he didn't kill himself. I don't know. Pick your conspiracy theory. Today in the newspaper, there's suggestions that he broke bones that are usually not broken when you hang yourself, but are broken when you're strangled. So we'll see. Emily, first of all, just like, should we deal with conspiracy theories? Should we think he was possibly killed, or is the suicide sufficient explanation?
Look, I mean, I am just the way I'm starting this out, you can tell I sound a little confused and torn. I think for me, the crucial question here is why Epstein was taken off suicide watch. And it may be that that is a terrible choice that reflects like the terrible policies at this prison, MCC, which has all kinds of problems historically and is not an exemplary place like many prisons or jails. It's really dangerous. So it may be that what went wrong here is not nefarious. But it is also true that this is a situation in which, given how high profile Epstein was, I don't think it's enough to just say, like, it is terrible that lots of people commit suicide in jails and to assume that this was a normal case, if that is even the right word to use, because it just seems like they should have been keeping some kind of special eye on him, especially since he'd had this previous suicide attempt. And like I said, it was such a high profile case. So, I mean, what got my attention was that the Attorney General of New York, Letitia James, said that, you know, she was really surprised that this had happened. Now, again, that could be about like a policy choice gone wrong or just the internal rules of the prison. I don't want to like go down the conspiracy road without any evidence. But I do think it's really important to investigate what happened here. And I can't rule out foul play from the get-go, given, right? It's like it's a situation in which you want to be open to the possibility of some kind of evidence emerging of a conspiracy. And even if you're not going to like start believing in it without that evidence.
So, yeah, I would, I mean, in Jeffrey Epstein's entire sort of story, right? His history, sort of where did he come from? How did he make this money? Who did he know? Who was also implicated? He has this like entire sort of mysterious, just very dark history. And so the way it seems fitting to me that this is the way his story kind of ended. And also I obviously understand why it looks like we're not getting the whole story. That was my initial reaction too. And I wouldn't be surprised if there was more here. I do find it interesting. The Attorney General talking about how he was appalled and found what happened to Jeffrey Epstein to be sort of unbelievable was shocking to me, because it's actually not surprising that there weren't eyes on him all the time. And part of that is just because there aren't enough people in a lot of these prisons, not enough staff to handle the kind of shocking numbers of people that are being thrown into jail every day, even on the federal level. So to me, both things seem totally possible. But it really does highlight the lack of oversight of people who need it in these facilities, and actually addressing people who might be suicidal and suffering from real mental health issues.
I mean, suicide is shockingly common in American criminal justice system. The Department of Justice has not released data on this since 2016, which I assume is some form of Trump administration, just like we don't really care about government data. But if you look back at the data from 2014 and before, there are just a ton of suicides. People try to kill themselves and succeed in killing themselves at a very high rate, which is not surprising because they're desperate and they're, most people who are being locked up are young men who are at a very high suicide risk anyway. It's not surprising when someone tries to kill themselves and or even succeeds in killing themselves in prison. It's also not surprising when people just die in a terrible way in prison, because did you guys look at this article that was in our research of just 32 other prison deaths, horrifying prison deaths, some murder, some suicide, some guard neglect, some people dying, right, because they didn't get insulin. I mean, just the indifference and the dehumanization of prisoners is pretty shocking under certain circumstances. And it sounds like the MCC as a facility was one that didn't put prisoner welfare at the top, middle, or anywhere really on the list of things that the staff and guards are taken care of.
One thing also to keep in mind is that it's not just prisons, right? It's not just correctional facilities. It's jails in particular, where the suicide rate is remarkably high. And that is notable because about 80% of the people who commit suicide in jail haven't been convicted of anything yet. This is pre-trial, right? And so you see this epidemic of people who are spending significantly less time in a jail than the average person spends in a prison. But the suicide rate, I think, is 2.5-3 times as high. And, you know, it is very, it just is another demonstration of how little all correctional facilities care and protect the people in their care. You know, the idea of these places as being sort of the new mental health facilities, the just holding cells for people going through any sort of public struggle, is so, I guess, it just is so tragic that we can't actually ensure that people can even decide to live through an experience like spending a week or two in jail, because that's just how horrible it is and how poor our healthcare system is in these facilities.
I was just talking about a form to Nora Jackson, who's one of the people in my book who experienced jail and prison, about this very issue. And she was pointing out that one of the problems with jail, so first of all, it's this very destabilizing moment where your life has come crashing down. And also, there's such churn. It's not a place where you settle into routine, where you necessarily find friends or some kind of like touchstones of a community. It's a place where things are constantly shifting around, and that can make it even more dangerous.
Emily, what do you think is going to happen with the Epstein case, with his death? Because obviously he can now not be criminally charged. He cannot be a witness. It's going to be harder to get him to testify against other people. He took to his grave tons of secrets and tons of evidence, presumably. Is this something where the investigation does need to continue with the same radiance and might, or where you just be like, well, you know, we got to wrap this one up because we lost the main guy here?
Well, that's a really good question. It is certainly going to make things much more complicated. There's going to be a lot of fighting over civil forfeiture or criminal forfeiture case involving his estate, where the government will presumably try to take a lot of his money. But it's easier to do that when you have a criminal conviction, which now will be absent.
Actually, can I interrupt and ask a question there?
Yes.
Which is, does his suicide make the presumption of guilt? Does that increase your ability to collect from him or decrease it? I mean, obviously you don't get the criminal conviction, but is there some sense like, well, this guy killed himself to avoid culpability, so we're gonna weigh that as we consider whether his estate can go to these victims or not?
I mean, that will be up to the judge, but as a sort of, forget about Jeffrey Epstein for a minute. In another case, you wouldn't necessarily want a suicide to be a presumption of guilt, right? I mean,
right.
We think of Epstein as a monster,
right.
And there are lots of reasons for that. But like, if you were making a rule that was not just about Jeffrey Epstein, you would get worried about that kind of presumption. So, I mean, the government is going to have to prove something about, they're going to try to put on evidence about what they could have proven, right, to get over this hump. But we don't necessarily want the judge coming into this thinking like, well, this guy killed himself to get off. We want the government to have to show that he was likely guilty. The other problem is the suits the victims are going to be bringing. They also are not going to have a conviction as they try to get compensation from him. And then there's the question of, you know, accomplice liability and other people who have, no one else has been charged in this case. There's been a ton of bad press for Ghislaine Maxwell, Epstein's ex-girlfriend, who, there are lots of allegations, was, you know, procuring underage girls and young women for him. And there are other names kind of swirling around with accusations too. It's possible that there'll be some documents in these raids of Epstein's properties that have been going on that will help the government bring those kinds of charges without his testimony. But you certainly imagine that, like, he went to his grave with information that he could have provided that would have implicated other people.
Do you think, Josie, that there is ever going to be anything that sticks on the people who are his accomplices, on the Ghislaine Maxwells, on the people like Prince Andrew or Alan Dershowitz who've been accused of gross behavior? Do you think that we're going to end with a jurisprudential decision against them, or this is just going to be vagueness and doubt?
Obviously, the intensity and the urgency of this case is now reduced significantly because they're not trying to bring, you know, they're not going to put him on trial. They don't have a June 2020 date, which was sort of the original thought of when this trial would happen. It really does put into question, obviously, what happens to the people that have been accused. And the real problem, I mean, we see this a lot in cases that have to do with sexual assault, sex trafficking, and in any sort of situation where the evidence against him, since we're talking about something that happened in 2002, and especially the evidence against the other people that have been implicated, there's not physical evidence, right? There's the narrative of these women, which I believe, but that's not often enough to actually convict someone in a criminal case, and especially someone who's kind of a minor player in this, or a more minor player like a Alan Dershowitz, versus the main player himself, Jeffrey Epstein. So it's possible, given the sort of the attention that this case has gotten and the outrage that people feel over his suicide, it's an uphill battle for prosecutors and for the criminal justice system to hold these people accountable, because they have protections that are actually very important, even if they might work against the public interest in this case in particular.
So before we wrap up, Josie, let's talk a little bit more about this rather extraordinary speech that Bill Barr made. I want to hear your thoughts about what he said about jails. And then also, let's just touch a little bit about this attack he launched on progressive prosecutors across the country. I was surprised by that, because the Trump administration in other guises has been in favor of criminal justice reform, and it kind of seemed to come out of nowhere.
Right.
And yet, this is the same Bill Barr who wrote the case for mass incarceration
in
1992. So I guess we were seeing that part of his history come show its colors.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one thing you can say for Bill Barr is that he is consistent. He's been sort of one of these architects of mass incarceration since his first stint as attorney general in the early 90s. And he has just kind of consistently, even when all the evidence has demonstrated otherwise, argued that more prisons, more people in prison is a good thing. Longer sentences is a good thing. Mandatory minimums are a good thing. Charging juveniles as adults is a good thing. He's really sort of an antiquated, almost barbaric understanding of the criminal justice system. And it's a little terrifying that he's the attorney general. But I found his comments, particularly about the jails and Jeffrey Epstein's death, to be so illuminating, because he expressed surprise. He said the people who are responsible for this will be held accountable. But he's actually responsible for this, right? He runs the Department of Justice. He oversees the system. It is under his jurisdiction to be accountable for the way that people are treated and the oversight that people get in prisons. And the fact that he demonstrated surprise is either completely disingenuous or deeply, deeply ignorant of the system that he should be watching. I thought the progressive prosecutor comments were also just so symbolic of the culture war that the Trump administration repeatedly tries to stoke. The idea that progressive prosecutors are a threat to public safety is, again, just completely disproven by the evidence, where in places like Chicago under Kim Fox, prosecutions are down and crime is down. In places like Philly and Boston, where prosecutors have said, listen, we don't want to focus on the low-level stuff. We want police to actually be able to focus on serious crimes that need to be addressed and where people need to be held accountable, versus wasting resources and time on over-prosecuting and overcharging people for small offenses. The idea that this is so offensive to Bill Barr's entire kind of perspective is such a sign that he is a danger to any efforts at criminal justice reform, and really puts into question whether or not this administration actually does care about criminal justice reform in any sort of real way when it isn't scoring them sort of immediate political points.
As we tape on Thursday, the world economy is all over the place. Things are wildly gyrating. Signals are being signaled in all kinds of directions. We have big recession signs coming out of Germany, which is one of the world's largest economies. China also seems to be in the midst of some kind of upheaval and potential contraction. There has been a dreaded inverted yield curve, which is one of those phrases that economics writers love to use, which I vaguely understand, but is this inverted yield curve is a strong signal of a coming recession. And this coming potential recession is a function partly of the fact that we've had a very long economic expansion and economies are cyclical, and so it shouldn't be surprising that you would end up with some kind of recession someday, but also the sense that there is real trouble afoot between the United States and China, the world's two largest economies, notably because President Trump has taken a very aggressive stance around China's behavior and has brought all kinds of tariff proposals to the table, some of which he's implemented, some of which he hasn't. And this past week, the Trump administration labeled China a currency manipulator, complained that China was not doing its fair share in buying U.S. agricultural products that they expected the Chinese to buy. And then finally, the president proposed new tariffs on $300 billion worth of Chinese goods and then retreated from those tariffs when it became clear that the economic markets and that the Chamber of Commerce types were not very happy about those tariffs. So there's a lot going on. It's very complicated. The president seems to be, as is his wont, putting gasoline where there can be gasoline put and matches lit where matches can be lit. But I will start with a different kind of question for you, Josie, which is, if a recession is coming, should Democrats wish for it?
I do not think that Democrats should wish for a recession. I think that recessions tend to hurt the working people, people who are already struggling. And so we don't want to encourage, you know, we don't want to encourage more economic tragedy for people who are already in the midst of it. But that being said, I think that, like, the economy is obviously President Trump's sort of main weapon in this upcoming election, right? And the idea that it could be at risk kind of presents a different playing field for Democrats as we approach 2020 and as this election comes up. And I think his willingness to put that to kind of his willingness to sort of encourage the risk of a recession in light of that is, you know, this man is, I can't say I have anything in common with President Trump, so I can never totally understand what he's thinking. But I find it surprising and puzzling.
You find what surprising and puzzling?
Well, you mean like that he's taking on China in this way that just seems to be such
risky,
a gamble?
Right, exactly. And to risk sort of the number one thing he has going into 2020.
Right. Well, I think he got himself into this kind of mano a mano with China and the notion that he has to show American dominance as part of his America First agenda. And either he believed that he had more leverage than he seems to have over China, or he just is blustering his way through it without a whole lot of forethought. You know, it seems to me that there is an argument for being more aggressive toward China economically. Like, they are doing some things with, you know, not being cognizant of American intellectual property rights and the problem of, like, our jobs going overseas, which is not just a Chinese problem, but is partially related to the changing economy and the way in which China's rising might has an effect on us. Like, all of those issues seem like they are worth rethinking, as both the sort of Trump brand of protectionism is doing, and then also some of the candidates in the Democratic field, like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, have been talking about. What I find just incredibly unstrategic is the idea that this is going to be the U.S. versus China rather than the U.S. trying to make a lot of alliances with other countries in trying to contain China and get China to behave itself better. We are just not – I don't see what's in it for the rest of the world when the Trump administration has alienated so many other countries and treated them poorly on, you know, economic fronts. I don't get what's going to be in it for them to be on our side, given the sort of other relationship tearing up that's going on. And that just seems like super counterproductive.
Yeah, I mean, this trade gets to all kinds of Trump's weaknesses. One is that his tendency to see everything as a zero-sum problem to solve, as real estate developers tend to, and as he in particular seems to. And trade isn't zero sum. Trade is one of these things where, in fact, if done well and done correctly, everyone benefits, or the benefits are widespread and help lots and lots of people. And so he's unable to think about trade in a kind of cogent way. His objections to trade don't align with the objections that Democrats have to free trade. He's not really concerned about the environmental impacts of trade. He's not concerned about the labor impacts of trade. It's really just sort of like a balance sheet. Like, they're exporting more stuff to us than they're taking of ours, and that's bad because that's just bad. It comes without, as you say, Emily, it comes without strategy. It comes without brain work. I'm not clear that the what the Democrats want to do is so great either. I when I look back, I think there's such a missed opportunity in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was exactly what you described, which was this trade deal, this elaborate trade deal, which did not include China and which created this strong architecture of free trade among lots and lots of other countries in the Pacific, that would have knitted the U.S. to other countries in the Pacific Rim in a very useful way, in which we abandoned, in which you can't find even a modicum of support from anywhere, left or right, these days, which is a real problem. Do you think, Emily, that as a political issue, Democrats should be supporting the president on tariffs, or should be supporting being hard on China? Or do you think that they should stay away from that, even if they agree with it?
I mean, I think there's some justification for that initial round of tariffs. I now think we've just like the Trump administration is going way too far, and that the hurting of the American economy is a serious issue right now. I mean, also, you know, every economist keeps patiently trying to explain that it is American consumers who pay the cost of the tariffs, not the Chinese economy, and that they are not the right tool for trying to get what we want from China and China in terms of China redoing some of what it does. So no, I don't think the Democrats should be supporting these tariffs, because they're, you know, hurting American companies and American farmers, and they don't seem to be accomplishing the Trump goal.
Josie, what do you think? Should Democrats be aligning with the president on tariffs, or what should their attitude be towards his kind of yo-yo tariffing?
You know, this has been something that Trump has just been obsessed with for decades, right? When you read interviews with him in the late 80s, early 90s, his entire perspective, and I think what you said is totally right, that it's sort of this real estate mindset of zero sum. His entire perspective has long been that, you know, Americans are getting screwed on trade, getting screwed. We should be increasing tariffs. And this is like a long kind of obsession of his. It does not strike me that this is a way to address the issues that he has with China are legitimate. I do not think that the Democrats should be supporting these. In fact, I think the Democrats need to be running on a much stronger platform of protecting American workers and American consumers in a way that the Republican Party has sort of abandoned, given who's at the helm of it. I should say that everything I know about economics I've learned from Emily's son. So I don't know. I don't know how much.
Speaking of, we can preview our sharenting discussion by saying that Josie and my son Simon have a very sweet relationship on Twitter that has nothing to do with me.
It's basically just him teaching me things and me saying, Simon, I know that you are like half my age, but I need you to teach me this complicated concept. And he always does it very quickly. I learn more from him than I did from AP Economics. So I'm very grateful.
Huh. I don't know. Anyway, I'm not allowed to retweet all of this per my husband's policy about sharenting. Anyway.
That's all I have to say.
How can you possibly follow that?
Yeah.
Politics has never been stranger or more online, which is why the politics team at Wired is making a new show, Wired Politics Lab. It's all about how to navigate the endless stream of news and information and what to look out for. Each week on the show, we'll dig into far-right platforms, AI chatbots, influencer campaigns, and so much more. Wired Politics Lab launches Thursday, April 11th. Follow the show wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-host cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
So let's go to cocktail chatter. When you are looking for a low-priced Chinese imported beer and you can't find it because of the dang tariffs, and you have to have a high-priced European imported beer instead, what will you be chattering about, Emily?
There is just this explosion of amazing reporting going on this month about our country's relationship to race, in particular the history of slavery and all the problems that came out of it for African Americans. So I'm talking about an amazing story in The Atlantic called The Great Land Robbery by Van Newkirk II. I think Josie can be part of this victory lap since she is close with Van and a former colleague of his. But this is, you know, I think part of filling in the history that Ta-Nehisi Coates started telling in his piece for The Atlantic years ago about reparations. What Van is writing about is this problem of Black property ownership being wiped out, particularly in Southern and Midwestern states on farms, by fights over title. There was also a powerful New Yorker article about this, a New Yorker ProPublica collaboration recently. So that's totally worth reading. My magazine at the New York Times has done this amazing project that's going up in the print magazine, in the paper, online. It's called 1619. It's about all the incredibly important ways that the history of Black people first coming to this country, brought here as slaves in 1619, have unfolded and affected every single part of American politics and society and culture. Just this big project that has turned out incredibly well, that many of my colleagues at the Times worked really hard for. So I recommend that. And then NPR's Throughline podcast, which is about history, has this great episode about mass incarceration and the history of mass incarceration, which I also really recommend. And it's really kind of tracing through how race relations and racism have affected where we have gotten with mass incarceration. It's a topic I thought I knew a lot about. I learned a ton listening to this podcast, and I'm glad to be like a very tiny part of the last part about American prosecutors. These are hard, difficult topics, but they are so important for understanding everything about American history and democracy. So we should all be feasting on them this month.
Josie, what is your chatter?
So I just want to say I also just have enjoyed so much. I haven't heard the podcast yet, but the 1619 live stream the other night was just incredible. And Van's story has I just am so proud, and I think it's amazing. I am loving Gia Tolentino's new book, Trick Mirror, which I thought might be something that not everybody had heard of yet. But it's number two on the bestseller list this week. So I might be behind and letting everybody know how great I think it is, but it's just, Gia is just like,
nah, it's worth it. I'm glad you're calling that one out.
It's so great. And Gia is just such an incredible writer. She has just the sharpest observation skills. She has the sharpest observations about being a woman in America, about being sort of a millennial, about what it means to grow up as someone whose job is to give opinions, as she put it. And I have just loved every single page of this book. It's really, really great. So I highly recommend it. There's a chapter in there about a reality TV show she was on as a teenager that makes the entire book worth it on its own. So definitely check it out.
What was the reality TV show?
It was like a reality TV show on a station called Noggin that I remember because they used to play Degrassi reruns, which was like a Canadian teen soap opera. They went to an island. They did different challenges. It was like teens living on an island, basically. I'm not totally sure what the ultimate point of it was, but this was 2004, sort of, you know, in the beginning of the explosion of reality TV. And just reading about her entire experience, both deciding to go on a reality TV show as a high schooler, and then like what it was like to tape it and the drama and keeping in touch with the people that she was with after, you know, now 15 years later. It's just hilarious and kind of sad and stressful and beautifully written.
I just want to also chime in to say that Gia's interview on Long Form was so good. It has great advice for young writers in it toward the beginning. And I just love her way of thinking about how the things she was good at and felt confident about, and then the things that she's sort of still feeling her way towards as a journalist. She's like incredibly self-aware. And I just thought it was like the best advice for a developing young writer I'd heard in a while.
Wow. That is high praise indeed.
Yeah, and I definitely need to hear that. I need the advice, so I'll be listening to that on my vacation.
We all need. Yeah, it was good advice for all of us, honestly.
My chatter, or two quick chatters. One is I would point you to an NPR photo essay about, it's called Separate and Unequal Schools. And it's a photo essay where they sent photographers to school districts that are right next to each other, but are vastly different because of the level of funding, the nature of the community that the school serves. And the photos are shocking. And it's real evidence of how just a very small difference in geography combined with class and race and public policy decisions can create totally different outcomes and opportunities for children. The photos, it's very, as someone I saw on Twitter, it's very East Dillon, West Dillon from the Friday Night Lights, where if you remember that show, there's this kind of one school has nothing and the other school has everything. And, you know, you have the one school district where there are laptops on every desk and the other school district where they're using school books from the 1950s that are in tatters and where the paint is peeling off the walls. It's very, very demoralizing and should be a real wake up to the way we don't give true opportunity to people in this country, to children in this country. The other chatter I want to do is totally self-serving. I'm in my brother's house. My brother's John Plotz. He's the smarter Plotz brother, the wiser Plotz brother, the funnier Plotz brother. So take that for what it's worth.
Better in every way.
He's better in every way, except he's shorter than I am, and he's older than I am. So, good.
I'm glad you're pointing those really important attributes out. That's definitely crucial.
But in anything that really matters, John is superior. And he has a podcast, which is called Recall This Book. He's a professor of English literature, and it's an interview podcast where he talks to usually writers about particular books. And this episode he has this past month is an interview with Shishen Liu, who's the author of The Three-Body Problem, which is this amazing science fiction series of novels. And he's this Chinese science fiction author who is so deep and so complicated and has led such an interesting and strange life. And John has this wonderful interview with him about philosophy, about science fiction, about literature. It's wonderful. So check out Recall This Book's interview with Shishen Liu. We also, of course, are collecting your listener chatters, dear listeners. And there's a rich vein of listener chatter this week. I was down a rabbit hole for about 40 minutes following links that you sent us, and please keep sending them to us. Tweet at us at Slate Gabfest. And the story that I really caught my fancy was sent to us by Matt Thompson at Thompson MW 1983, and it was an LA Times article about the Coast Guard's only icebreaker. So you could say, given what's happening with global warming, maybe we don't need icebreakers. But the Russians have 11 icebreakers, and the United States military, which is spending, you know, ungodly sums of money all the time, has just one. It's incredibly old. It's certainly older than Josie. It's probably almost as old as you, Emily. It's not quite as old as me. And the poor boat, it just barely can float and barely can break ice. And it's just, you know, the sewage is spilling everywhere. And it's just about what happens when you neglect something, which is important. And it's also about these sailors or these Coast Guard officers who are trying to keep this poor boat going. And it's a really very funny, sad, and lovely story about a form of icebreaker neglect. That is our show for today. The Gabfest is produced by Jocelyn Frank. Our researcher is, of course, Bridget Dunlap. Gabriel Roth is the editorial director of Slate Podcast, and June Thomas is the managing producer of Slate Podcast. For Emily Bazelon and Josie Duffy Rice, I'm David Plotz. Thanks for listening. Please come to our live show in St. Paul, Minnesota, September 18th. Go to slate.com/live to get tickets to that show. And Emily and I, and I think John, will talk to you next week. Hello, Slate Plus. How are you? You might be on vacation, Slate Plus. And if you're on vacation, you might be on vacation with, say, your children. And if you're on vacation with your children, you might have taken a scenic picture of your child on a water slide. Or perhaps your child with a farm animal at the farm that you were visiting. Or child on a hike. And you're faced with a question, which is, do I share that picture? How broadly do I share that picture? With whom do I share that picture? You're facing the dilemma, which apparently is called sharenting. And here to explain sharenting and tell us why sharenting is good or bad are Josie and Emily. I'm too old to have sharented anything. Actually, that's not true. I've sharented a lot now that I think about it. Hannah, my wife, has sharented all these stories about our children, and I hate it when she does that, but so it goes.
Oh, interesting. All right, well, we got to hear more about that. But we should also say that part of the reason we thought of this topic is that there was a recent article, I think in the Times, in which some kids whose images have been shared a lot by their parents were pushing back and saying, hey, this wasn't a choice that we made. Josie, I am dying to hear what you think about this because your son's pictures on your social media feed, like, make my day. He is but a toddler. So I wonder, you know, you obviously have made the choice to share a lot of images of him. Do you set limits? Do you feel like this is something you'll stop doing when he hits a certain age? Like, tell us your thinking about this.
It's funny because when I saw that video on the Times, I was just picturing my son who is can't even really speak yet. He's 22 months, but he certainly seems like he's going to have that sort of personality where he gets annoyed with his mother easily. I could see already him getting mad at me about sharing pictures of him. You know, it like wasn't really a conversation. My husband's also a journalist. It's not really a conversation we really had. My husband definitely shares less in general than I do. But I do think the older that he gets, and I see this a lot online of people sharing stuff that's kind of cute now, but later will probably be embarrassing, right, for their kids. Every single sort of misstatement or cute but embarrassing thing that their kids did. And I imagine that, like, it's so difficult to have any control over your public persona if everybody knows about you, or, you know, if everybody's been sort of watching you publicly for forever. So I might need to tone it down. But, you know, the other thing I always think about with my son is I don't know if it's the trade-off, but the accompaniment to that is just how much of a history he's going to have of his childhood that, like, I didn't have. Like, my parents didn't take a ton of pictures of me. My grandma took some, but, you know, there were, like, what, 20 pictures of me per year growing up, maybe max. And then my son has, like, 20 pictures a day. He's going to know exactly everything he did every single second of every single day. And probably so will a lot of other people if I don't stop posting cute pictures of him. But he is very cute.
But
he is so cute.
He would know that whether you share it or not, right? I mean, because you're going to take the pictures whether or not you share them.
Yes, definitely. Then that's the sharing is not a critical part to the pictures. I'm just hopefully when he's mad at me later, I can tell him that this was there are pluses too. And I think it's weird, like the more that I've now had people kind of who are angry about my work or the work of The Appeal.
That was just a snippet from our Slate Plus conversation. If you want to hear the whole conversation, go to slate.com/gabfestplus to become a member today.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS, we are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.